Hello and welcome to the Jake and Gino Show. My name is Gino Barbara. I'm one of the co-founders of Jake and Gino, and today's guest is Faris Gosia. At just 29 years of age, he's the owner and founder of Faris Gosia Capital, where he owns and operates his own 600 units and is trending towards 350 million multifamily assets sold in 2023. Without further ado, welcome to the show, Faris.
Thanks for having me, guys. Appreciate it.
Let's jump into it. How old are you?
29 right now.
So for anybody out there listening saying, oh, I'm too young. Oh, I'm too old. Oh, I don't have enough money. I don't have enough time. It's just one of the excuses we put in our minds, one of those limiting beliefs we have to really stop ourselves from achieving our dreams. I was just at a life coaching event with Phil McCurran. It was a couples coaching. And he actually said there's two things, time and money. Those are the two things that people always blame. And it's rarely about the time or the money. And in this instance, Faris, you're 29 years old. How did you get started in multifamily in real estate?
Yeah, so great question. I actually got started out of, I was trading stock options. Really didn't like it. Very volatile. So
Let's stop right there. Yeah. I already like you, bro, because stock options is a lot of fun. You jump in there. It's every day. Yeah. You're probably drinking 5 Red Bulls. You're going at it. You're making $6,000 one day, losing $8,000 the next day. So how did you get into that?
I was started reading about puts and calls, and it just seemed to make sense, you know, and hey, I can buy a put out the money and still make money on that. So it seemed like there was risk adjusted returns, but you know, with anything, it's not easy. So just, got real nervous there. I ended up selling positions where I would have been in the money. I just couldn't hold on. So yeah, my parents like, hey, why don't you try a house? You know, you can't sell that so quick. If you don't, you know, you got to stay with it.
Stop right there. Okay. So your mindset goes from day stuff, like hours shit, to a business that it may take 3 years to go full cycle in a deal and actually refinance or sell a deal. How did you overcome that belief? Because that's got to be very difficult where you push a button, make $5,000, when in the next instance, you may have to wait 18 months to make $200,000. How did you overcome that?
It's a great question. I think I was very open-minded just to try it out. My parents had 6 rentals back home. So nothing crazy, but you know, they always made money from them. And I saw that growing up. So I figured, you know, why don't I try this out? And I think the mindset for me, the shift was, to go big when I was working my W-2 job as a tennis coach, and the first tenant I ever had drove to the club and they handed me a check for $1,200. And I just stood there. I remember it just looking at it like, wait a second, what did I do here to make this money as I'm walking back in to make $30 an hour, you know? So that was a defining moment in, I think, my real estate career to just keep going and keep buying.
Faris, you're making this too easy for me. When I recap the show, I mean, come on. This is like tennis coach. You got your selling options. You got people driving, dropping off checks to you. I mean, what was the first deal? What did that first deal look like?
You know, it was just a $100,000 house in Munster, Indiana. First ever deal. That's what it looked like. That was about 4.5, 5 years ago now.
And how did you get into it? How did you know what to do? How did you know how to buy it? Do you still have that deal right now?
Yeah, I actually still own the house. Funny enough, I didn't really know what to do before jumping in. I just saw the house. I literally the same day, I was like, this looks like a decent deal, actually. You know, because it looked like it rented for $1,200 on Zillow. So I put it under contract. As everyone does, their first deal, the inspection report came back. I'm wanting to back out. There's, you know, a doorknob's loose. I'm like, oh no, this is terrible. but stuck with it, you know, bought the house and then actually figured everything out from there, like how to put it on Zillow, how to screen the tenant, you know. So I think just jumping in the business teaches you more than anything can, from, you know, reading bigger pockets. So I think that first deal really is key.
And what I love about that is I just interviewed one of our coaches at Jake and Gino, his name is Joe Sullivan. And I said, Joe, can you give me a couple of tips on how new investors should start? And Joe's got 1400 units right now. He's within 3 years, he's scaled up massively. And he said, I'm going to put an asterisk behind what I'm saying here. But he said, just go out and take action and don't worry about it. And that's exactly what Faris here has done. You don't have to go out and buy 100 units. You just have to go out and take some kind of action. Now, it would be irresponsible to continue to buy deals and not get educated, not understand what you're doing. But I think if you can figure it out that I'm a former pizza guy, Faris is a former tennis coach / options trader / I don't know what else he's not telling us, because I can only imagine what else he did in his former life. But I'm just saying it's just taking that massive action and understanding that it's not rocket science. If a pizza guy and a tennis coach can do it, it's just starting out there, figuring it out, picking the market, buying the deal, and then going, okay, how do I do this? And then all of a sudden, you're the W-2 employee and you have people paying you. that's such a paradigm shift. It's like, wait, I'm waiting for someone to pay. Now someone's paying me. That was the complete mind shift. So you bought that first deal. You start doing all the work. What's the next deal look like?
Yeah, great question. So the next deal actually was just another – oh, no, actually the next deal was a duplex on that same street. Crazy enough, another one came up, two single families, you know, duplex style, and I bought that one. I figured, you know, three on the same street, nice to have them all together. So that one actually came right after the first one. It closed in the same 2 weeks. So I just jumped into that. So those were my first three units. And then the next deal was the following year, about 6 months later, because it was November. So January, so 3 months. That was a four-unit deal. So are my first three deals.
And Farish, you're still playing tennis. You're still managing these deals. I mean, at what point do you say to yourself, I got to stop teaching these 60-year-old ladies to play tennis? I mean, when did that gig end?
So that actually ended right as COVID began. Because as you know, like service kind of industry shut down. So I had about 35 units at the time. And tennis was, you know, it was over for me, but COVID had stopped it for about 3-4 months for just every tennis coach out there pretty much. So at that point with 35 units, I decided to go full-time real estate, which meant I was actually getting into more of the brokering side as well, because I would do a lot of reach outs to owners and I would come across a ton of buildings. And obviously at that time, I didn't have the money to buy everything. So I met my now co-founder of Ellsbury at that time, who was like, hey man, if you're coming across these deals, why don't we sell them if you don't want to take them down? There's other buyers out there, not just you, you know, which is a great point. So that's what we did on the brokering side.
And how long did it take you to scale to 35 units?
It took me about 2 years to hit 35.
Wow, that's awesome. So it takes you 24 months, everybody, someone in his mid-20s who's teaching tennis to get into real estate full-time. Then he sees the opportunity that he has because he's sourcing deals off-market and he says, ha, I'm going to multifacet this thing. I'm going to get into the brokerage side. Now, I don't recommend that for everybody, but it's another way to add another stream of revenue. And then obviously, I want to touch on the property management. That's another stream of revenue that Farish has got. And then the syndication, if he wants to get into raising capital, that's another revenue. When did you start getting into the larger multifamilies?
Started getting into that about 3 years in. So when I hit about 35, 40 units, my first large deal was a 14 unit that popped up.
All right.
So I bought that one. I actually refied a couple smaller deals like a duplex to get into that 14 unit.
And as far as capital goes, where were you finding the capital for these deals early on?
Yeah, great question. So a lot of the capital for the large deals came from refinancing out on the smaller ones I bought. They ended up being very good deals. Because obviously if I'm reaching out to a bunch of owners, I could kind of cherry pick what I would buy. So I ended up refinancing out basically all those 35 units, scaled into a 14 unit, a 28 unit, a 32 unit, and another 33 unit that next year. And then just like before, for example, the 28 unit I bought for 1.7, it just appraised a year ago for 3.2 about 8 months later. So then I refied those to buy a couple bigger ones.
So is it safe to say you're not going out and buying Lamborghinis? You're actually taking this money and refinancing it and actually putting it into the next deal?
Correct. Yeah, I live in a 200K condo. I'm not buying anything flashy.
Yeah. But we joke about that, and there's nothing wrong with that. If you want to do that, it's just going to take you a lot longer. And what I love what Farish is doing is we say, Jake and Gino, people do not make money when they buy real estate. That's the whole flash. Everyone's always saying that you make money. You actually make a lot of your money when you exit real estate, whether it's through a refinance or through a sale. And now, I don't know if Farish has owned the smaller properties, the smaller homes, if they're still doing really well and he's at great price points. But at one point, if he hasn't refied all his money out, he can just sell it. We talk about putting a deal, quote unquote, on our imaginary conveyor belt. His conveyor belt started a few years ago with one single family, then a duplex, then a four unit, then a 14 unit, then a 20 unit. And that conveyor belt starts stacking up and he's able to repurpose that capital, pull it out, and end up going in and putting into the next deal. So you start buying these bigger deals. At some point, do you raise capital or do you continue to buy deals internally for yourself, just yourself?
No, I keep buying internally for myself. At that point, I think my cash flow right now is about $100,000 a month from all this stuff. That helps. And the brokerage, I think I make a little more than that. So I'm just using my own capital right now. I haven't gone out and raised any money.
And then as far as that goes with the brokerage, how are you leveraging the brokerage? How are you utilizing the brokerage for your part of the business, or are you?
Yeah, so great question. So right now we have 10 brokers with Ellsbury that are calling across the Midwest to source deals. We're buyer's brokerage actually, so we reach out to buyers in specific markets and say, hey, you look like you have a great portfolio. You look really active, look like you're buying. We want to help you grow and scale with you. Because obviously with me buying, we understand the need to have decent deals. A lot of the brokers that list stuff, it's great. They get the sellers max price, but you know, there's not a lot of buyers out there for the max price stuff right now.
Mm-hmm.
So we do that for other buyers. And then obviously we can just put a couple of people in areas that, you know, I'd like to scale in to try and source some deals that way. And obviously they get paid a fee whenever they find something. So.
And the property management, you said you have property management in-house. How did you build a property management company?
Yeah, it started off small. So when I had about 100 units, I hired my first maintenance guy. I was still basically the admin, the office guy.
So you're the I'm a guy. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. I'm going to cut the grass. I'm going to burn my hands on the carburetor. I'm going to go out there
whack. I wasn't that guy. I hired the maintenance guy. I couldn't do that. I'm definitely not handy. I can't change the light bulb. But I could lease it out and stuff like that. So that's what I did. The 100 units, I hired a maintenance guy. I was still doing all the other stuff. Then when I hit about 220, I hired my president of the company. So then he took over that role and I hired a second maintenance guy. And then from there, it was just the typical, you know, hire maintenance guys as you go, leasing agent, VA.
So when was the first, at how many units did you hire your first leasing agent?
Probably like 300-ish. So
what made you wait for that long?
My president was still doing most of that stuff. Like he was still doing the show and that sort of stuff. So.
Wow. And so you're scaling at this point. Any tips on scaling? I mean, this is challenging to go from zero to 300. Your president's doing the leasing. You're hiring maintenance techs as it goes. What have you learned through the process of any tips on scaling?
Yeah, great question. So I've definitely learned to hire ahead if you can find the talent. So if you're planning to keep growing, it's always better to have the heavier payroll than lighter. You never want to lose a key piece and then you're trying to plug a hole, right? So mm-hmm. you always want to hire ahead, especially in the maintenance department. I don't know about you guys, but finding maintenance guys in this day and age, I didn't think that would be the toughest part of the business. It's really tough to find good maintenance techs. So I think that is one thing that I've learned is definitely hire ahead to not have to plug holes.
I think the problem is that COVID really, really hurt that because all of a sudden the gig economy comes. You can go drive for Uber. You can go work for Amazon. You work for Walmart. You make a ton of money. I think things are starting to stabilize. And that's what I love about this part of the market right now. The cycle, things are starting to get back to normal. You can hire. Whereas 2 years ago, it was really difficult to hire. So Faris, give me a couple of tips when you started out. Some of the things that you came across, some of the mistakes you made trying to get into multifamily, trying to scale up into the bigger deals.
Yes, some of the mistakes I made at the beginning, I think especially on the single family stuff at the time, you know, I was overpaying a little bit. I could have paid a little less. In hindsight, my first deal actually didn't appraise out. I was so excited just to buy the single family home. I called him and just offered him way too much. I just wanted to buy another one. It appraised at 104 and I offered 110 and it appraised at 104 and I didn't even say 104. I was like, oh, I'll meet you in the middle at 107. I even covered an appraisal gap. She was like, okay. So just definitely way too excited to buy real estate. So, you know, that was one mistake I made. I think a lot of the other mistakes I've made are the same as other people. Like, for example, waiting to implement a management system like Buildium. You know, just because mm-hmm. you wanted to save a little money using a free site like apartments.com. When you're trying to put 200 units over to Buildium, you know, it doesn't help. So I've told other people who are starting, like, hey, just start right. Start like your business. You know, treat the tenants like, you know, obviously with respect. But, hey, you know, put a ticket in the system. Not like call me at 9 p.m. I'm available to try and get a plumber out for your toilet kind of thing.
At what point did you do that though? Because that's important because that'll burn you out. The I'm a guy gets burned out by doing that. And, us, it was around 100 units we started doing that.
Yeah, that's I think right around 100, like I said, was where we put things on Buildium and I had a maintenance guy. So that's right around where I was. But yeah, 70 units, taking the calls and doing all that stuff it's tough. I always say getting bigger is easier than staying at like 50 units. You know, I think 50 to 100 is probably the toughest. And then once you can get past that 150, 200, it just gets – it's all about the people then, you know, the hiring process.
What markets are you investing in?
Right now, Northwest Indiana for the most part. I've touched Central Indiana a little bit. My next deal is coming up in Plymouth, which I would consider more Central Indiana. But for right now, those are markets that I currently own in.
And what do you like about those markets? I mean, they're probably in your backyard. You probably have the vertical integration going on as well.
Yeah, exactly. It's in my backyard, so I know it well. Have the staff here to operate stuff. I love other markets, Wisconsin, Iowa. I just haven't found anything that's 100 plus that I really like that much. You know, like I said, I'm not the kind of, I don't have the ability to go out. Well, I do, but I don't want to. I don't go raise the capital and put 30-40% down these deals. So if I'm using my own money and I don't think I can get it out that quickly, I don't want to put it into 150 unit in Iowa and then my money's just kind of stuck there, you know? So
Give me the reason why, or let me know your thoughts about syndicating and using other people's capital. Why haven't you broached that yet?
Honestly, so for me personally, the way I've looked at stuff is if I can own 100% of the 100 unit, I don't have to own 1,000 and have 10%. And I know different people look at it different ways, totally, because then on exits, you can definitely get, you know, a nice win on that exit. But for me, I've always wanted like less is more type thing on that, and just get paid for as much as I can with what I own.
Do you think that'll ever change?
It's a great question. I think it would have changed if I had seen deal flow where I thought there was enough value to go out and buy it and then exit it or refinance it. But right now, I don't know about what you guys have seen, but I'm seeing a lot of – it's tougher to find that margin on deals. A lot of sellers want future value on stuff, which then gets really tough for me to kind of pull the trigger on bringing other money in, you know.
This part of the market cycle – the last 2 years has been more extremely challenging because the cost of capital is a certain area. Then you have the cost that you have to return to your investors is another. So let's say cost of capital right now is 6%. And then your pref is another 7. So you've got to find a deal that cash flows at 13% to be able to actually syndicate money and actually make that deal work. It's been challenging. So for us, we syndicated our first deal back in 2018. We've done 3 syndications. We've exited 2. It's not our model either because we're able to use our own capital and we have employees now that are investing in our deals. So we're able to find that capital. It's a great tool though. A lot of people use it to get into the business. So when you're out there, you're saying, oh, I don't have the money to get into it. Well, there's creative financing. There's a lot of seller financing going on right now. And there's that capital that you can use from investors to actually start scaling as well.
Yeah, and I definitely think for people trying to get into the business, I think it's a great way to get into it, to go buy that first deal. It's definitely better to go buy a deal and use other people's money than to not buy the deal, right? So that's definitely the thing. It's just tough for me to take bandwidth away from what I have going on, to go buy a deal and then I have invested money that I have to then look after and make sure I'm, you know.
Your model is very similar to ours because we're vertically integrated and we work on the premise of profit per unit. I mean, I don't know, a lot of listeners don't know what profit per unit is. You take the number of units you have, you divide the profit, you get a profit per unit. I mean, on average, last month's was $280, I think, profit per unit on ours. Now, if you're out there raising capital, that profit per unit is going to be significantly less. But the positive is you have acquisition fees, you have asset management fees, you have less capital in the thing, so there's less risk and you're able to scale. But when you have a property management company that you're running yourself, it's very difficult. I hear Ferris saying, I can't hire maintenance guys. And then you got Gino going, hey, Ferris, I got another 400 units on deck. You're like, Gino, I can't get maintenance techs. Well, if you have third party and you're using, it's a lot easier to scale a lot quicker. That's why the profit may not be there. But if you're in it for the long term, that may be the play. So as you're listening to this, it's not one size fits all. We have a lot of students and coaches who come on and go, I don't have the capital. I'm going to start syndicating. Let me start raising money, get acquisition fees, and start getting some exits. And then, oh, wow, I got a 20 unit in my backyard. I can JV this with another person. That equity is mine. So don't say to yourself, I need to do one thing. It's not one size fits all.
Yeah, you can definitely do a blend. Yeah, I think that definitely you can do a blend of stuff.
And
yeah.
What is your buyer criteria? What kind of deals are you looking for?
Honestly, my buyer criteria is typically 1970 to 1990 kind of build, average finishes inside. I don't really do heavy rehabs. I just think, again, the value is not there on those right now from what I'm seeing anyway. I haven't seen one where I think I can put $1 million in and get the return I need for the time it takes and the effort. So typically just a 1970, 1980 product, lower rents, you know, older owner, doesn't want to raise the rents, not sure if the tenants will stay, that kind of stuff. So really just an operational play.
Mom and pops is what you're saying, basically, correct?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. 20, 30 year old, 30 year legacy owner.
And then unit mixes. Do you like ones, twos, three beds?
I don't like anything higher than a 3. I'll do some 3s. I just think when you start taking turn costs into account, it just gets tougher there with more walls, more carpet, more vinyl. So I like the 2-bed 900 square foot, 1-bed 800 square foot.
And how
that's really
what are your rents? Electric. What are your rents on 3 bedrooms?
3 beds out here. If it's a townhome, you're probably looking into the high thousands, like 17 to 19 for a 3-bed townhome. For an apartment, you're probably 16. And then twos, you're probably around 1200 to 1400, and then ones 900 to 1100.
And it's interesting because you can still, that turn cost is still okay because you're still getting pretty good rents. It depends about the demand where we are in our market. Three bedrooms are not, I'm not gonna say they're not scarce, but they're not common. So when we do have three bedrooms, you know, we have over 1500 units scattered. Some people looking for three beds, we can move them into a three bed because there's not a lot. Yep. We bought a 12 unit property last year, 12 units. It was all three bedroom townhomes, home run of a property. Nice. Because it's all contiguous. Yeah. And we actually launched, you know, we put it onto another, one of our offices, one of our districts. Each district is about 200 units. So that 12 units is being managed as part of a 200 unit district. And that thing's a home run. We've rehabbed them. Like you said, they're a little bit bigger. The turn costs are a little bit more, but I mean, dude, it's like you said, $1,700 to $1,800 in rents. It's an absolute home run of a deal.
Yeah, if you buy at the right price, I think it makes a lot of sense.
So you want to buy right, manage right, and finance right. How are you financing these deals right now?
Relationships with banks, so your typical bank loan. I haven't really used agency yet. I just think there's a lot of headache that goes into trying to obtain an agency loan. I'm pretty impatient, so.
Barrett, we're going to have a conversation after this podcast, and I'm going to direct you to some agency lenders because I want to see some of that stuff come off your balance sheet. I want some non-recourse loans. I want to get some interest only for you. There's a lot of joy. And listen, we did the very same thing. What we did when we started out, we went community bank, then we refi to community bank. And then the second refi was the agency. So we got that's the trajectory. I'm not putting words in your mouth, but I can feel you, brother. I know that that's the path that you need to go on because you start getting stuff off your balance sheet. It goes non-recourse. You're getting 30-year AMs. You're getting 3, 4, 5. I mean, we're actually going to Fannie right now. We're going to get a 55%.
You can get a 10-year.
Yeah, we're going 55% loan to value with a 10-year IO. And the reason why we're doing that is that we bought, like you said, when you buy these deals right and you're able to explode the NOI, look at the deal and go, and we're still able to pull out a ton of capital. But for the next 10 years, that's off the balance sheet. It's a deal, Ferris, also that we're going to hold. And it's a deal that we like because we've repositioned. What is your exit strategy in a lot of these deals? Are you looking to continue to hold these deals long term, continue to turn over the portfolio? What does that look like for you?
Yeah, I'm definitely a long-term hold guy. So my end goal is probably upwards of 25,000 units. Realistically, I think I'm going to be in the business, hopefully, for the next 70, 80 years of my life. We'll see.
Wow. So and family, married, kids?
No kids, no. Not married, working towards that.
I hope you have a big family because that's a lot of units to be giving away to your kids, man. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, that is true.
That is awesome. Financing. Let's get back to financing though. So you're saying relationships and all. How did you finance the first few deals?
First few were just conventional loans. So not a commercial bank, obviously, just your regular, any lender can, you know, do a conventional loan. So that was my first few. And then after those, obviously you run out of that real quick. So I'd have to go commercial lenders on the next few. Even though they were smaller, I still have to go commercial. Even now, if I'm buying a duplex, I'm commercial. But,
and commercial. Yeah. So you're using like community banks or using credit unions? What are you using right now?
I use a credit union for a couple, more so community banks. I've used Wintrust. They're a larger bank. They're probably my main bank. So yeah, banks with probably like $4 to $5 billion on the books is the size of the bank I'm trying to use.
Wow, that's awesome. And then so you continue to buy. Are you looking? You said you're looking out, but you're not looking. So what is the plan going forward for you? Do you want to continue to buy these assets? Are you going to bring other partners on? Are you going to continue to build a property management, build a brokerage? What does that look like for you?
Yeah, so the future, obviously trying to continue to scale the portfolio and trying to buy more. This year, my goal was to buy another 400, but it's been a little tough. So I think I'm at like 125, 150 for the year. Just with where rates are and like with what sellers want right now, it just gets very, very tough to pull the trigger on deals. And brokerage wise, yeah, continue to grow that, continue to grow the team. Obviously, the more deals that come across my desk, the better. Just to see where the market's at. I feel like I have a pretty good pulse on a lot of states just by seeing what sellers want, right? So by people saying, hey, I think there's a crash coming in a year, I don't think there is, at least where what I'm seeing. None of these sellers are even talking at a price that is close to fire selling, you know?
And so what do you do when you talk to brokers that have these prices that just don't pencil out? I mean, how do you go on and have that conversation by saying, hey, you're offering this at $5 million. This deal pencils out at 4.1. Like, what do you do at that point?
You mean when we're trying to talk to a seller about their deal?
Yeah, or you're talking to their broker or their broker. How do you have that conversation without quote unquote insulting them? Because it's been challenging the last couple of years, where, like you said, they want to get paid on their future. Yeah, I know rents can go to 900. You're at 400 right now. So why don't you bring it to 900 and then I'll buy it based on 900.
Yeah, exactly. No, I think, well, we don't really talk to many other brokers. Well, I don't when I'm buying, because it's mainly, you know, my brokers reaching out to people. But when we're talking to sellers, I mean, there's really no good way to tell them that their price is off. You know, you try and tell them and they just get offended and they don't take it too well.
So how do you maintain that relationship though? Because you want that seller to, once he comes back to his or her mental faculties and says, you know what, Ferris was right. This has been sitting online for 6 months and it hasn't sold. Maybe I should go back to him and list it with him. How do you keep that relationship intact without trying to insult them? Or do you?
Yeah, no, great question. So what I'll specifically tell them, hey, you know, the price I'm at right now is this with where rates are. But if you take it to the market, and I don't tell them to list it with me. I just tell them, if you take it to the market, there could be a situational buyer that's going to pay this price. You got guys in 1031 exchanges that always will overpay to pay a large tax bill. Mm-hmm. So, you know, situational, I'm like, hey, take that to market. You never know if you get that price. I think that's the best thing that you can do. I'll let them know to just put it on the market and go from there. Because realistically, if the market does pay them that price, then I was wrong. They were right. They can get it, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, but if they don't want to and they want to maintain an off-market relationship and sell it down the line, then we'll just, you know, remain friends, keep chatting, and kind of see where things go, monitor their rents. If they can get them up, like they say they can, and rates come down, maybe it is a deal with it.
Ferris, where do you see multifamily? Are you bullish on multifamily? Where do you see the future for it?
It's a great question. If I wish I had that answer, that, you know, but I think it's going to always trend up, right? I don't think we're ever going to see, from my point of view anyway, a major downturn in multifamily. Some of these coastal markets like California, I can't make sense of any prices people have paid with that 2.7% 10-year debt, but they have such a long runway, right? So if they can hold the deal in their books for 5 to 10 years, I don't see them coming out any lower than they were at, because it always trends up. So I think long-term, definitely bullish as always on multifamily, but are we going to see another spike like we have in the last 3-4 years and the returns that people have captured? I don't think so. You know, it's been insane. Some of the returns people have been able to achieve in the last 3-4 years in some markets.
And what's going on in your market right now? Are rents pulling back or expenses accelerating? Is insurance going crazy in your market? Talk to me about what you're seeing.
Yeah, in our market, I haven't seen insurance prices go up at all. Actually, they've been pretty constant. I'm not sure about other markets. And then rents-wise, they've gone up about 5%. So the average, I think, you know, from 2 years ago, they've been up like 30%, you know, year over year. 2 years in a row, boom, boom, 30%, which is crazy. And that's why people have been able to capture the returns. But yeah, last year to this year, I think it was about 5% roughly was what I've seen.
You're lucky, Ferris, that you live in where you live, because a lot of the coastal areas, a lot of the areas that are challenged, even internally, whether there's hurricanes, there's earthquakes, there's just natural disasters going on, their insurance has gotten hammered. I mean, you're talking over $1,000 a unit in Houston for certain areas. Florida, a lot of carriers are actually pulling out. So understanding what you need to be an expert in your market. You need to know where rents are going. You need to know the employers in your market. You need to know what the expenses are. You need to know what the income is in the market. Understanding all that. And the reason why I'm saying all that is, one of the last questions that I need to pose to you is, I'm out here, I'm at a W-2 job. I want to get into multifamily. I mean, I've got Pizza Guy talking to me right now. I've got Ferris, who's sub 30. He owns over 500 units. What should I do to start to get into multifamily?
Yeah, I think it's so unique for everyone. And I think, number one, someone who's looking to get into multifamily, like truly looking to get into it, and they live in like a very high cost living area like San Fran, it's going to be so tough, right? The deals don't even make too much sense there. So I think for a start, you got to buy in a place that does make sense, even if it's not right next door to you. But I think you are able to transact in your own backyard. And by that, obviously, there are buyers and sellers in your area. So maybe it looks something like reaching out to people in your area, you know, and understanding your local market. And then by that, you can build connections and start doing something in your market to make extra money, whether that's wholesaling or whether that's a finder's fee or get a license and start listing some product. Again, that was my path to what I've done. But I think everyone's path can look different. But for me, there's only certain areas, in my opinion, that work for multifamily for what people are looking to do. If you're looking to exit a W-2 job, buying in San Fran is great for appreciation, maybe. But if you're looking for cash flow to have freedom, I don't know if that market's going to help you that much. So You got to buy where it makes sense for your goals, right?
And that's, I love that you just said that you need goals. I mean, I think you can buy in San Fran if you want to exit. You just can't exit with cash flow. You have to exit with appreciation. Cash flow gets you out of your job. Appreciation equity keeps you out of your job. That's the reality. So you have to understand what your strategy is, what you're trying to accomplish. And if you know, that's why for me, joining these mentorship groups is so important. Because if you're in San Fran and you can't find the market, then you go out and you find someone like Faris who's investing in a market that you can't invest in, and possibly partner up with Faris and say, hey, I've got capital, let's partner up here. So that's an important thing. But understanding your goals, understanding what you want to accomplish in multifamily, and it may be just to supplement income. It may be to get rid of the job. It may be just to be able to find another vehicle to be able to invest. I mean, that's really, really, truly important. What are your...
Yeah, and I think like another thing real quick on that. I think sometimes too, people don't understand how much power knowledge has. Like even someone with a W-2 job, if you bring me a 100-unit deal with massive value, like I'll pay you a few $100,000 for that, or you could even be in the deal with nothing. So I think they don't, like, there's a lot of power right now to have a knowledge of real estate and just knowing the right people, right? So going out, like you said, mentor groups, networking, joining the right you know, teams and classes, stuff like that. I think that really helps.
So what Faris is saying is go to jakeandgino.com/webinar, start learning this stuff and start educating yourself, because you don't know what you don't know. Because one of the limiting beliefs is I need money to get into this business. No, you need knowledge, you need experience, and you need a deal, or you need to be able to provide value. Because if you go to Faris, hey, I'm a maintenance tech, I'll take care, I'll be the head of maintenance for the five guys, I will run your five guys, I'll be head of CapEx, can I get 5% equity if I put money in the deal? I think Faris may think about that and go, that sounds like a pretty good deal. I don't have to worry about maintenance. I got this guy. And all of a sudden, if I want to start building, he can start doing development 3 years down the road. You just never know. Negotiation is powerful. And being able to provide value and bring value to another operator, another owner, another investor is how you get into any venture, especially multifamily.
Yeah, I think that's totally true. Providing value really does. Providing value at a high, like a high price, provides value to you at a high price. So, you know, servicing, like being an Uber, yeah, you get the few bucks for providing value there, but providing a $50 million building to someone who wanted a $50 million building provides you value back in the millions.
That's right. Faris, where can the listeners get a hold of you?
They can get a hold of me at fariscasillacapital.com. If they want, there's a little submit button there. They can also email me if they'd like at farisgarcia3@gmail.com.
So it's Faris, FarisGosea.com, correct?
Faris Garcia Capital.
Capital.com.
Yeah, and then ElsburyGroup.com too. They can go there as well if they like.
Now, we have had a great run in multifamily, going from 0 units to over 250 million in assets. That's over 2,000 apartment deals that we've been able to purchase through our framework, Buy Right, Manage Right, and Finance Right.
Now, Jake and I, we created the Jake and Gino community back in 2015. We launched our first book, Build Our Profits. And since then, our students have closed over 60,000 units. That's over $4 billion in assets they've been able to close over the last 6 years.
And that's why this community has been so successful. We call it results-based education, and we pour back into the community everything that we've learned on our journey from 0 to 2,000 units and all our systems and scale that we use on our very own property management and investing companies.
Jake, I love that. It's not just education, it's implementation. So what I want you to do, click on that link down below, apply to work with our team, see how we can help you on your journey in multifamily. Ellsbury Group. So you have a young Faris Garcia who's out there trading stock options, puts and calls. He's shooting guns. He's making $1,000 a day, losing money. The next day, he's just hitting buttons on a computer going, this is not
like losing.
This is not the way to create wealth. It just isn't. This is great. Transactions pay the bills. Equity makes you rich. And then he realizes, you know what? I'm a tennis pro. I'm teaching tennis, making $30 an hour. It's fun. It's great. I'm able to sit outside, put some suntan lotion, hit the ball around a little bit. And all of a sudden, someone drops off a $1,200 check and he's scratching my head. I'm like, wow, I got to work 40 hours to make the same amount of money that I did with this $1,200 check. And like, I like this real estate gig. And he thinks big. He started small. He bought one house. And then from one house, there's two houses. There's duplex. And then from a duplex, you keep scaling. And then a 14 unit. and then a 20 unit and understanding the business, he took massive action and then understanding the education aspect of it, continuing to work hard, continuing to invest in the business, not only extracting money from the business and investing inside the business, because now if he wants to go out and buy the Lambo, he can stroke that check if he wants. Not a big priority to him. To him is to continue to grow the business and to continue to grow his portfolio. That's what he wants to do. And that's what his whole, I think, his whole focus and his whole goals are. And, you know, if you're listening out there, have you even set goals? Have you even thought about getting into multifamily? Because right now is the time to get into multifamily, because there will be a correction in the next 24 months as rates continue to stay here, as we go into recession. Brokers are calling you back, although prices may not have corrected where they need to, but they will. It's called the market cycle. It's going to happen. You just need to be there to be able to have contacts like Farris to call him up and say, hey, Farris, you selling anything today? If you don't have the brokers and the relationships, if you haven't done property tours, if you haven't selected a market, if you don't know how to underwrite a deal, then you're just wishing. And wishing is not goal setting. Set the goal, start today, because in the next 24 months, there are going to be opportunities. Any final last words, Farris?
No, I think you nailed it. And I think, you know, even my goals get into this. I think if people are like, I can't imagine having that many units. Like when I got into it, I didn't think this would be my goal either. You know, they just shifted as I went. I thought if I could own 20 to 30, that'd be fantastic.
Woo, so, 20 to 30, right? Yeah. Maybe 100 units. That's what we want, right?
Yeah. So I just think if people just get in the business and start, then from there, they can kind of shift as they need to. But I think just getting in is important.
Farris, I want to thank you for joining us today. And as always, everybody, we're real people, as Jake says, real people doing real deals. Thanks, everyone, and we will see you on the next episode. Take care.